that I think this is one of the large contributions that Johan has made. But the two things I would like to pose to him, or make an observation then pose to him. One of the things that I think he forces us to do is to to think positively and negatively all at once. To achieve, in other words, a type of thinking that would be capable of grasping life. It's kind of like both at the same time. Now that's very difficult to do, I think. But I think, and sometimes Johan doesn't pull it off, but I think that for the most part he does. To think negatively and positively at the same time in order to move towards something better. Transcend is a notion, I think, of that. So there's always this notion of the more in this thinking both. And I would just like to pose that question, to ask that of you to help us think a little bit more about the more. Particularly the more in the context of what I call the real dilemma of this world, the relationship between the one and the many. Because I think that the way to the future is how it is that we philosophically how one reconciles the one and the many. But it's more than that. It's being able to articulate the notion of the more, but within this context. And so I leave that to you.
Thank you. May I ask?
After 15 by 11, not only negative peace, but also positive peace became one of the most important peace policies for the 21st century. In your book, Peace by Peaceful Means, you mentioned that Kant hoped for the republics and the democracies. It seems for me that you regarded Kant as a negative peace theorist. I would like to ask you that my interpretation is correct. Maybe you don't like Kant. But what do you think about Kant? What is a good point and bad point of Kant? And also, you are skeptical about the Kantian thesis that democracy is necessarily peaceful and criticize that democratic peace theory which advocated by Bruce Lassett. As I mentioned in the morning, democracies fight against non-democracies, even if democracies almost never fight each other. It is true that Lassett tends to focus on pair of countries leaving out the context. However, I have to say that democracies are more concerned with the public opinion and citizens' interests. So I think deliberation is very, very important among the citizens. This is a hypothesis Kant wanted to say. What do you think of this hypothesis? And I know you support the notion of global democracy in other different places. And propose alternative models for the global democracy. And you deal with globalization, and democratization, and democracy, in particular for food. For peace and global democracy, it seems to me that the role of citizens, citizens' movements, in particular peace movements, is important, I think. If you have some ideas, please tell us the relationship between peace, in particular, positive peace and global democracy. So I mean the positive between, what is the relationship between the positive peace and the global democracy, not the national democracy. And between peace movements and global democracy. Finally, I'd like to ask you what we as a citizen of the world, that is to say, world citizenship, do for world peace in the age of the war on terrorism. So the reason why I ask this question is that I believe you are a citizen, a world citizen. I think if we become world citizen, kyosei means living together peacefully, will be more easily realized without losing difference between us. towards the perpetual peace, Kant, maybe we don't like Kant, but I talk about Kant. Towards the perpetual peace, Kant believed that world citizenship or cosmopolitanism was important. It shows the kind of cosmopolitan ideal. So please tell me what do you think about Kant's ideal of cosmopolitanism and world citizenship?
Thank you.
Well, the primary question which was assigned to me a week ago is whether John Galton is pacifist or not. That was a kind of rougher and much more brutal question to me. As you may know, the Mennonites are plain people, slow to judgment, and good at judgment. And there is a very famous phrase by a Mennonite theologian, John Howard Yoder, that the Christian ethics for Christians. And sometimes it is the dilemma for ordinary Christian pacifists to speak up, to put words what's in their convictions into a secular world, the language without faith language. And my academic mentor in the United States, Ted Koontz, always says something about Christian pacifists have a kind of a dilemma between their own language of faith, which is the first language or mother language, and the second language. It's a more secular, scientific, academic language. And there is a contradiction or at least tension between them. So, as I have been listening to Johan talking about transcendence and positive peace and many other familiar concepts and words, I was thinking of this first language and second language things. And I would like to simply affirm your contribution to the construction of the frameworks and theories and concepts in order for us to see better and deeper of the things which have happened in front of us. And then I would like to put some words about these things, which is in my mind in terms of my first language and second language. You said about relationship, and it reminds me of the Bible as the book of lots of narrative stories of relationships. We have seen in the Bible the relations of God and human beings. And in my first language, I call it Revelation. There is also dramas and stories of human interconnectedness or interrelationship in the Bible between human beings, sometimes hostile, sometimes fraternal, sometimes devastating, sometimes hopeful. And in my first language, it would say ethics. And we also heard you saying love is a significant component of positive peace. So obviously, many Christians have a lot to learn from the Bible concerning love. And in my first language, it would be agape. You also said dialogue. It is not conversation, but rather it's an encounter with the otherness of someone or something which is totally different to the self. And this is also the biblical message of encounter with the other two things. Humans cannot be God. God is different. It's an absolute other. In this sense, the biblical narrative is a story of dialogue, or the memory or record of dialogue between two distinct beings. We also heard you saying empathy. The term reminded me of also the biblical story, some of the words of the prophets, which says this happening, seen from God's perspective, was bad or disastrous. Whenever a Christian reads the Bible, we are invited to see things from the perspective of God. We are challenged to step on the realm of God's perspective. And it is also exemplified in the biblical narratives. In my first language, it may be humility, and in the German word, it's a traditional Baptist German word, Gelassenheit, yieldingness. You also said about transcendence. It's not just win-win resolution or, you know, deal is done kind of thing, but rather it's a jump into new reality. In my first language, it may be called a transformation. I personally don't like the word conversion. It tends to focus on the mind, human mind, and something happens in the heart. But rather, transformation, I'd like to imply that it's change of thinking as well as the change of being, or, you know, what we do, more physical thing. So, as I listened to Johann Galton, it was a very insightful, full of knowledge, and insightful second language for me. And this is very much helpful for me, and as well as for any Christian pacifists. So I admire your contribution. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Johann, would you like to respond to the commentators now, or you want to reserve it?
To keep the ball going, to start with Atsuhiro. I like the two languages, and I'll just try to explain my own reaction to the word pacifist. I don't use it, and I don't use non-violence very much, because that's a negative. Mm-hmm. You see, it is simply that. There's nothing against it, absolutely nothing. And my first book was about Gandhi's political ethics. But I noted that Gandhi had the same reaction, and for that reason didn't use Ahimsa or Satyagraha, clinging to truth. I'm experimenting now with the word assertion, as opposed to aggression. It's an assertiveness that does not hurt. And I find it, for instance, in Swiss farmers who try to push them. Mm-hmm. You're pushing me? Mm-hmm. I kind of like it. They are as reactionary as you can get them, but I kind of like it. Pacifist, I was a conscientious objector, I would still have been today. I spent half a year in prison. It's the place where I completed a book on Gandhi's political ethics with my beloved Norwegian professor of philosophy, Arne Næss. And you see, the image of pacifist is a little bit too wrapped up in the ego. And that's to save your own soul by keeping yourself away from the dirty things. And I will do the same today. But you must understand what I have tried to do is to wed theory and practice. Mm-hmm. And I know where it comes from my father, who was a physician. And he was a professor of otorhinolaryngology and at the same time a respected surgeon in that field of the body. And the way in which these things were seamless, what you say, moving from theory to practice, back to theory, and that one enriched the other, was so obvious. So it became part of my existence. The question was how to find the key to do it. And of all places, it started in 1958 in Charlottesville, Virginia. I was a so-called promising young sociologist and took my PhD students down to Charlottesville to study desegregation. And planning of course to write a book. And at that time the idea was that you cannot combine science and politics. And to me came indirectly the sheriff and the mayor saying we are threatened by violence. This is Thomas Jefferson's city. It's an iconic city. Threatened by violence. You have interviewed 2,000 people. You know more than anyone else. It was true. Now what is it? And it certainly struck me that that was more important than my book. So I came up with a proposal. And they desegregated Mumbai. And I got a letter from the mayor. And that kind of stuff. So I was then launched, and then, as a matter of fact, I ended on the first page of Washington Post for the first and last time. I think I can guarantee it was the last time too. And I was 28 at the time, so bye bye Washington Post.
You think this combination of practice and theory,
so, you know, you all know the slogan, there is nothing so practical as a good theory. So I have, of course, inverted it and said, there's nothing so theoretical as a good practice. And you suddenly say, hey Lord, it worked. There must be something to it. Now, how do I convert this practice into a theory? Then it suddenly struck me that what I tried to do without knowing it was to create a new reality that transcended the views of the participants. Because they got stuck. Okay, in that new reality, as Finney says, there is both and plus alpha. And that is exactly what you picked up, namely, there is this additional element. You bring in something new. You bring in something new, so you suddenly suggest a peace zone between Ecuador and Peru after three devastating wars with millions, thousands killed. And that zone exists today. It became the peace treaty in 1998. They even used exactly the sentence that I had said. A natural park. But it has now become a market zone where Ecuadorian and Peruvian peasants high up in the Andes meet and exchange products. And that zone has given rise to mini zones along the border. And the European Union has given money to a road connecting the zones. So, you see, this is peace breeding peace. And to me it was much more than I'd ever hoped for. Peace breeding peace, the self-sustaining peace. But not self-sustaining in the sense that you stay at the same level, but you go ever higher. More and more. Okay, let's accept sky is the limit. So, this has been the kind of reasons why pacifism and nonviolence didn't express enough. But nothing against them, but they are not key words in the vocabulary. And you will notice that in the mantra, nonviolence is still there, but I am experimenting with that version of words. There is something to learn from the Muslim expression jihad. It does not mean holy war. It means exerting yourself for the faith. And the Muslims said there are four ways of doing it. The one is the big jihad. That's the struggle between God and Satan inside yourself. But they're very dualistic, very dichotomous, just like fundamentalist Christians. And when I have to talk with them, I put in a little word for Satan. Can't you give Satan just a little chance? No! Lala! Okay, it's okay. So Satan doesn't get much of a chance. I like Satan a little bit. Give him a chance. Let him show his better side. Second point is through writing, through the word, through spoken and written words. And the third level of jihad is through trade.
that you spread the faith by being a good merchant. And that means having human relations with your clients and being honest. So why is it that in Chiapas, the southernmost part of Mexico, they are now making a Muslim community of merchants? Because for the first time, they have found merchants that are honest. The totally new experience. Spanish colonialism didn't bring that. And the current Mexican state doesn't do it. American capitalism, for certain, doesn't do it. And suddenly it happens. And the fourth level, the small jihad, is that by the sword or the hijacking, you defend your faith against those who try for it. Well, that's one vision. And there is something to pick up, the positive expression of jihad. Instead of interpreting it as war, you interpret it as exertion. So this has to do with the languages that you pointed out so well. Now, Osama, you see the same, you have the same the same name as Osama bin Laden. So it's the Loken bin Laden.
Osama, not Osama.
Well, you see, it is actually in Arabic, Usama bin Laden. don't attach yourself to bin Laden. You're doing just fine. Now, democratic peace theory versus Islam. And I can go a little bit more deeper into my critique. I can say the following. You see, more than close to 80% or 90% of countries in the world today have democratic elections, because they have all learned that that's the thing. And they have also read this theory, and they assume that if they have elections, there will be no war. Because they assume that Washington believes in that kind of and practices it. But Saddam Hussein had not multi-party, but multi-person, one-party elections. But those persons were quite different. It's not absolutely obvious to me that multi-party elections with the same type of people are that much better than one-party election with different type of people. So let us just have a little glance at the US democracy. It's about one thing. It's to get a televisable personality election. And this is done by two parties. They can call themselves reps and dems or elephants or donkeys, whatever. The task is the same. Mm-hmm. Namely, to get enough money to pay enough TV channels to put that guy up front. Now, if they are doing the same kind of thing, you should not be surprised if the parties become quite similar. It is absolutely wrong to assume that one is the party of the rich and the other is the party of the underprivileged. Example. Democratic National Committee came to Berkeley where there were 2,400 NGOs for peace and development and environment and women's liberation and blacks' liberation and black women's liberation for environment, putting in peace and all of that. Absolutely everything was there in Berkeley, in the Bay Area. And you would imagine that the Democratic National Committee would be interested in having a dialogue with their future doctors. Not at all. They went straight to the rich people in San Francisco to get money. Didn't visit a single one. Why? Because the task is no longer politics in the terms of interest of groups, but to get your guy elected. Now, it's obvious that the guys become similar because they are trying to corner the same market. So you have to have a somewhat similar product. And that is why New York Times could make a little cartoon about John Kerry. If I had been president, I would have bombed Baghdad in a totally different way. Brilliant. So democracy, goodbye. You don't even have to cheat. It's goodbye. It's not democracy. Unless you spell it M-O-C-K in that case. So, having said that, I could then say to us that you save your theory by rejecting the idea that the U.S. is democratic.
you can just say it is no longer democracy, and that's the reason why it intervenes so much. Why it fights in Yugoslavia, why it intervenes in Chile, why it supports the coup against democracy in Algeria. But just wait till you get more democracies in the world, and you will see the theory break down for everybody's eyes. Because the fault lines are the same. And the fault lines are culturally between Catholic Protestant Christianity and all the rest, with Judaism coming in as honorary Christianity. You have politically against those that are accepted as democracy, against the rest. But they were traditionally in a club called OECD that also was the economic upper class. Are they willing to admit lower class members? Or will they say your democracy isn't firm for the time? They'll find all tricks like that. Economically, you have between the exploiters and the exploited. And politically, you have between the manipulators and the manipulated. And these four relations are basic to imperialism, and they go together. And the democracies we had until the explosion in electionism started, all were on the Catholic Protestant side, the economic upper class, the politically manipulating class, and militarily, they had the means to enforce it. Now, that fourth dimension no longer exists because of people's will. Only a fool would try to confront the U.S. with an army, with airplanes and things like that. You do what was done at Baghdad Airport the other day. Somebody had put up a sign, "Welcome U.S. Army to the Second Vietnam." Mm-hmm. The sign was torn down relatively quickly, but there were enough photos taken of it before it was torn down. And that's it. The U.S. is militarily powerless. There's no way it can beat the people's will. And interestingly enough, Bush gives the explanation. He said at Arlington Cemetery the other day, "We fight them abroad so that we don't have to meet them at home." Mm-hmm. Wait, if you do that, you see, then you have to send an army. And you have fish out of your own water. If you had met them in Buffalo, for instance, a charming town, and you had fought the people's war in Buffalo against Canadian invaders, then you would have learned something about people's war. But since you always intervene abroad, you have no chance of learning. So goodbye, military superiority. These are important things, and they happen that way. Now, you asked very, very important thing about Kantianism. So let me try to... Is Kantianism negative peace? Yes, it is for me mainly negative peace, except for universal hospitality. Except for that. I love that. I was asked by some authorities in Spain to indicate the contract between host country and immigrants. Because the universal hospitality, like any hospitality, has to have a certain informal contractual element. And I suggested two very simple things. The immigrant, the person who benefits from hospitality, if he is staying, not only a visiting guest, has to learn the rules of the place. That means the basic traffic rules in an expanded sense and the language. Moroccans who come to Spain, the part of Spain where I live, have to learn not only Spanish, but Valencian. And they learn it very quickly. Now, on the other hand, the host country has to reciprocate through dialogue, respect. Picking up something of the local culture that is coming into them with the immigrant, and trying to find how they can be enriched by it. So it is a dialogue, it's a mutual relation, it's equality. I don't find Kant elaborated that much. So I'm not accusing Kant of having thought what I have thought. I'm just saying that universal hospitality becomes a little naked. Now, as I said, the basic problem I have with Kant is that it's tied to the state system. I am tied to something which is my fanaticism, a culture of peaceful conflict resolution. Just like a conflict, just like a cultural hygiene, washing your hands, brushing your teeth, and so on, prolonged our lives by 25%, much more than the physicians do. They just take some emergency cases. Conflict hygiene. Just knowing how to handle a conflict.
Mm.
That there is more to it than fighting it out or maybe a compromise. Negative transcendence, positive transcendence. Much more to it than that if you have complex conflicts. Learn something about that and you are much better equipped. I'm of course then open to critique. This is reductionism to conflictology, and it is critique. And I'm quite willing to be open to other approaches. I don't find that in Kant. I don't find it. When you say in the conflictology, I advocate is this creative alpha element so that humanity progresses. And give you just a stupid example. You can go to Istanbul and you find along the waterfront glass verandas. And each restaurant has a glass veranda outside. And you can then start thinking, which conflict is a glass veranda a transcendence of? You work history backwards and you think, aha, there must have been some guy who says, I want to see this marvelous waterfront, but it's winter and it's cold. So I want both to have unimpeded vision and reasonably heated room to enjoy my food. The result is the glass veranda. And the glass veranda, then you can put plants into it and you get all these alphas growing. It becomes beautiful. You can't progress that by simply taking the contradiction in a conflict, incompatible goals, working on it to make a synthesis which is richer than a compromise. So a compromise would be, we invite you to sit 5 minutes outside and eat quickly, and then when you get stuck in freezing, you get inside. That's a marvelous compromise. That's the best thing diplomats come up with. And they would then issue a communique saying the chemistry was good, we had deep reflections, and there was a deep understanding. And then they come up with me. Well, and I'm not very kind to diplomats, and it's not the only way I enjoy it. Democratic peace theory, I'll make one more point from my 12. You mentioned that democracy is based on popular consensus. I agree. And that's exactly what Margaret Thatcher...